Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got a lovely show today. We're going to be talking about one of the under-recognized but really exciting institutions in recent American media history, community radio broadcasting. And we'll have as our guest one of the great figures in community radio broadcasting and alternative media in the United States today, Norman Stockwell, joining us on WILL AM 580. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The policies of the U.S. Postal Service have always encouraged small publications and independent ideas to flourish. Political magazines of all stripes are cornerstones of public debate. But that founding American principle was ignored earlier this year when the Postal Regulatory Commission, or PRC, voted to adopt a drastic rate increase that was proposed by publishing giant Time Warner. As a result, hundreds of small and independent magazines from across the political spectrum are struggling to stay alive. Teresa Stack, president of The Nation magazine, explains.
Time Warner's argument is that these very highly efficient, which also tends to mean profitable, publications should be rewarded with lower postal rates, and the postal burden should be shifted to the smaller publications that are more labor-intensive for the post office to deliver. You know, on a strictly cost basis, they're right, but that's not what postal policy has been for 200 years.
The PRC says that the new rates will encourage small publishers to take advantage of what they call mailing efficiencies. But Stack says many of those efficiencies end up being a bigger burden to many small magazines and periodicals.
If you are an odd size magazine or a high frequency magazine, you cannot do this. The technology doesn't exist. The printers don't have the capacity to even handle all the current, what they call co-mailing demand from the market. The Nation tried to do co-mailing this summer. It delayed our delivery by 7 to 10 days. And we're a weekly. You can't do that, you know? I mean, it's just like not possible.
The Nation isn't a nonprofit institution, yet it has lost money every year for 137 years. Profit isn't their motive.
We think there are very important ideas that need to be part of any sort of vibrant, functioning democracy. And if you believe in those ideals, you need vehicles to get them out there in the public arena. This is a labor of love and an intellectual pursuit. Not everything is about making money. Time Warner, on the other hand, their primary goal is, and I think this is, you know, this is fairly indisputable, was that they were going to save tons of money. And they spent millions of dollars to get their rate plan enacted. A bonus to getting their plan implemented is that it makes it much harder for competition. You know, it's not so much a political thing as, again, a market thing.
The severity of the PRC ruling has caught the attention of Congress. The House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform will hold a hearing on the rate increases on October 3rd. For more information, go to stoppostalratehikes.com.
The fight for public access television in Philadelphia dates back to at least the early 1980s. But last week, the city and cable provider Comcast finally forged an agreement to create public access channels. Inja Coates is a member of the Philadelphia Community Access Coalition. Coates says the coalition's members are all media makers who understand the power of the media to create change.
It was the vision of knowing what public access could do to really transform our city and our communities, especially in a city like Philadelphia, which is characterized as a city of neighborhoods and just lots of little pockets of different cultures.
Programming is the visible aspect of community television, but public access activists also emphasize the production side of community media.
The opportunity for people of all ages to be able to come into a center and be trained how to use the equipment and how to put together a show and have the opportunity to submit tapes. You know, that in itself is really, really an important part of public access.
Coates says the battle for the public right to television access is part of the bigger national fight for public resources, which have been whittled away through the years. 17 states now have laws that threaten public access funding or free cable companies from mandates to provide funding for community television.
The fact that we have succeeded is not just a victory for the people in Philadelphia, but it's really a victory for the whole country because it validates public access and inspires people in other communities that they can fight this fight. And it's not just here in Philadelphia, but everywhere. These different struggles may seem local, but the impact is much broader than just what happens in each individual town.
For more information about Philadelphia's fight for public access, go to PhillyAccess.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking about media, as always, but specifically about community radio broadcasting, nonprofit, non-commercial radio, its history, its legacy, where it's at today, and what sort of future does it have in the age of the internet. And joining us to discuss this is probably the best qualified person I could find in the nation to take on that issue. Norman Stockwell, the operations coordinator at WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin, but someone who has been closely connected to community radio broadcasting nationally and internationally, one of the best-known figures in the field, and who's often visited Champaign-Urbana, meeting at WEFT, our local community radio broadcaster. So it is a pleasure to welcome here to our mobile studio, Norman Stockwell.
Well, thanks, Bob. It's great to be with you here on the program, and thank you so much for having me and giving us an opportunity to talk about these issues on your show.
Well, you know, I guess right at the beginning, an editorial confession, my radio career began because you gave up your slot at WORT in Madison in the mid-1990s and gave me a chance to start doing my show. And then when I moved down to Urbana, I had a backlog of shows I could hand to the station manager, Jay Pierce, and he said, okay, we'll give you a shot on Sunday afternoons.
Well, we were glad to have you, Bob, and we were sorry to lose you to our neighbor to the south.
Well, let's talk about, for listeners maybe not that familiar with what community radio is and how that is different from what they're listening to here, NPR station, WILL AM 580. What is community radio? How is it different from, say, NPR?
Sure. I mean, in the United States, the FM dial is segmented at 92. Everything below 92, and this dates back about 40 years to 1967, everything below 92 is what they call non-commercial radio. Everything above 92 is commercial radio. And we know commercial radio, that's the folks that sell us soap and things like that. Non-commercial radio further divides into a couple of different categories. There are religious broadcasters, college and university broadcasters, and what we call public radio with a small p. Now, public radio with a small p further divides into community and public radio with a capital P. Mm-hmm. We're here today on WILL, the public radio station, and public radio stations tend to be parts of statewide, regional, or national networks. People are familiar with NPR, obviously, if they're listening right now.
Sure.
Community radio stations are licensed to local communities. In Champaign, you have WEFT. In Madison, we have WORT. There's probably, of the stations like us, probably somewhere around 80 or so around the country that are these standalone, independent community radio stations. Then there's a lot of mixtures. There's a lot of stations that are maybe a campus station that also uses community volunteers, or a community station that also takes NPR programming like Morning Edition or All Things Considered. So there's a lot of mixtures out there. But the essential difference in community radio is the use of volunteers. Community radio uses volunteers from the local community to do all aspects of the programming. And so whereas on a public radio station, you tend to have paid hosts doing most of the shows and the volunteers are helping out in the background, in community radio, the volunteers are involved at every level. The other thing is community radio is able to focus more locally because it is a local service. And so where public radio might say, oh, we can't cover that issue because it's not of interest to our listeners statewide, community radio doesn't have that barrier.
Now, when did community radio begin in the United States?
Well, community radio actually started before public radio and started in 1949. A fellow by the name of Lewis Hill was a conscientious objector to World War II. He worked in a conscientious objector's labor camp, basically breaking rocks to build a road. And he had a lot of time to think. And he had worked in commercial radio himself. He had worked in the D.C. area doing commercial radio and was always bothered by the fact that he'd be in the middle of reading a news story and he'd have to stop to do a soap commercial and then come back on and do more news. And so he said there really should be a way of creating non-commercial radio. But he also said there should be a network for peace. He said all of commercial radio is beating the drums of war. And this is, you know, again, 1949, just coming out of World War II.
Yeah, he said there should, Cold War.
Yeah, he said there should be a network for peace. And so he created Pacifica Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And when they started, they got an FM frequency, and nobody had FM radios back then. This is 1949. FM was a brand new concept.
Yeah.
And so they actually had to give away radios to get listeners. And so they gave away FM radios. People tuned in and listened. And then they went on the air, and they said, if you like the programming you're hearing, send us some money. And they were absolutely amazed that the money came rolling in, that people felt it was an important enough service that they wanted to support it with their dollars. And these were actually dollars. I mean, these were like crumpled dollar bills. They weren't, you know, big checks from corporations. And so from that was born the concept of listener-supported radio. And that concept has now evolved. And so we have, you know, National Public Radio with fund drives, and we have public television with their pledge drive marathons and so on. All of that came out of this concept from Lou Hill in 1949.
And Pacifica, which I think is fairly well known nationally, is sort of the emblem of community radio, now has five stations in its network, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Pacifica has five member stations, if you will, in the Pacifica Radio Network, but it also has over 125 affiliates.
Mm-hmm.
And those affiliates are the small grassroots community stations, college stations, low-power stations that broadcast Pacifica programming, but they're not owned by the network. And so it's really, it becomes a very large net cast across the whole country, and the listenership is nationwide.
Now, people oftentimes say, okay, well, there's NPR, that's supported by the government, that gets government money, that's why it doesn't have commercials like WILL, AM 580. And then the community stations are supported through pledge drives.
Well,
that's not exactly accurate. Though,
no, let's unpack that a little bit. I mean, in fact, if you want to talk about government support of radio, the United States is probably sort of very low on the ladder compared to most other countries around the world.
Support.
Yeah, where governments actually support radio either by dollars or by providing facilities or staff or whatever. In the United States, we have a thing called the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is a non-governmental organization that receives government funding. And that then gives out grants to, I think there's about 500 stations around the country right now
that get
money from the CPB. And that includes public stations, but it also includes some community stations. It also includes some college stations.
Some or most community stations? Do you know offhand?
I would say some, but I don't have a hard number for that. WRT certainly receives money from the CPB, and there's certain requirements. You have to have a certain number of paid staff. You have to be on 24 hours a day, things like that. But in our case, we've been getting CPB money for a couple of decades now, and it's about 20% of our entire operating budget.
So it's pretty much the same percentage of the budget the WRT, a community station, gets for its budget that an NPR affiliate gets, most main NPR, like WILL. I think I looked at their numbers, I think they get roughly the same amount from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Yeah. Well, your CPB funding is based on what they call your NFFS, your non-federal funding support. And so when you can show more support from your listeners in your community, you get more dollars in your share from the CPB. So it's a good system, I think, and it's isolated from most government influence because it is a separate corporation. But always, every year, there's the concern of whether or not the Congress and the president are going to sign a budget that authorizes future funding for the CPB. And so that, of course, comes before Congress, and it's sometimes held as a stick or a carrot to try and influence programming on public radio. But the attempt, at least in the creation of the CPB, was to have a kind of a firewall between the politics and the funding. Now, you mentioned pledge drives.
Yeah.
And in our case, we get over 61% of our entire operating budget from individual listener donors. Very often on public radio stations, you'll hear them saying they get 60% of their programming budget. And the difference there is a lot of public radio stations are located on college campuses, and they're getting their infrastructure support from the university, either through the form, the electricity, the staff salaries, the health benefits, and so on. So that's getting covered through university systems, often, not always, in the public radio world. But listener dollars make a huge, huge amount of difference to us being able to do what we do in all forms of non-commercial radio. You know, the way I like to talk about it is that in commercial radio, people think, oh, well, I don't have to pay to listen to that. But you do. You pay because the advertisers are paying the station by buying advertising time, and they're expecting that you're listening and they're going to sell you their product. So you pay every time you buy soap.
Well, it even goes beyond that, because the channels that the commercial stations get are given to them at no charge, scarce, extremely valuable channels. It's like giving a chunk of national forest to a private company at no charge. So it's an indirect subsidy that the commercial stations get to even exist.
Yeah, there is a licensing fee for commercial radio, but it's nominal. Very minimal.
It's nominal. Our guest today on Media Matters is Norm Stockwell, the operations coordinator at WORTFM in Madison, Wisconsin, one of the leading community stations in the country. Norm is here not only in that capacity, but even more important in his role as one of the national leaders of community radio broadcasting and independent media in the United States, and as someone who's traveled worldwide covering as a journalist all sorts of political events and media conferences, global radio. He really knows the entire waterfront of radio and alternative media like few people in the United States. Our number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Please do call in. I'm Bob McChesney, of course, your host. We are coming to you live today. Before we get back to the conversation with Norm, let me follow up on a point he mentioned about pledge drives. We're going to be having our own right here on WILL in a couple of weeks. 2 weeks from today, we've got our special two-hour pledge drive show, and I hope you're going to tune in. Andrew O'Boyle, the show's producer, and myself, we've been working very hard to put together a special show this year during the pledge drive. Bill Moyers is going to be on the show with us that week. John Nichols. We're talking with Amy Goodman to get Amy back. Should be a terrific show 2 weeks from today. Please listen and please have your checkbooks and credit cards ready on that day, because we definitely need your support. As I think Norm just pointed out, 20% of the revenues for even the most successful community and public stations tend to be the max amount, or pretty much it, you're going to get from the government. The rest you have to raise yourself, and that's why we depend on listeners like you to keep programs like this one on the air. Norm, one of the things I'd like to know is, let's say someone's listening to the show right now and they're living in Peoria, or they're living somewhere in Bloomington, and they say, I would like to start a community radio station in my community. Can they just go start one?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Bob, because in about a week or so, the FCC is opening a window to allow people to apply for new non-commercial radio frequencies. It's the first time in about 15 years that a window for applications has been opened. And
so
it
the
may
answer
be
for 15 years would have been no, you're out of luck.
Well, yeah,
now
well,
you are maybe in luck.
Yeah, I mean, basically the radio dial, particularly the FM dial, is pretty full in most of the United States. Obviously, with some exceptions, there's some large areas in the Southwest that have no FM signal coverage at all. There's no stations. But But generally, certainly in the urban areas of the country and surrounding, there's a lot of stations on the dial. And one of the things about radio licensing is stations are protected from stepping on each other. I mean, I couldn't put up a radio station right next to WILL on the same frequency because I would step on your signal. So in this short period of time, they're going to allow stations to apply for new licenses, allow groups to apply for new licenses for stations. And out of that, we're going to see quite a few new community radio stations emerging around the United States.
And these will be below 92, and then the left-hand end of the dial there at the non-commercial zone?
That is correct.
Any idea how many of these new stations will start?
No, I don't want to hazard a guess. I mean, I think that there's a lot of people that are preparing applications in different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of areas where there simply isn't any room. Certainly in the large urban areas, it's not even there's no room available. But in some of the kind of middle range areas, you know, here in Wisconsin, there's some rural areas that are going to be applying for stations. We may see three new stations in southern Wisconsin in the coming years.
Norm Stockwell, I want to talk about a lot of issues with you, including the internet radio, and global issues. But I really want to go through community radio broadcasting in a little more detail. It's your area of genuine expertise, and we here have a great community station in Champaign-Urbana area in WEFT, which many of our listeners are very familiar with. And if they aren't, I hope they'll become familiar with. You know, one of the things I've noticed writing about community radio, and I had the privilege, to use that term very loosely, of covering the Pacifica crisis of the late 1990s and writing about it in some detail, was there seemed to be recurring problems with community stations that don't really exist in public stations and certainly never exist in commercial stations, in terms of how they're managed, the tensions that come up. And, you know, I know that WRT over the years has had its share of these, like everyone else. Let's just talk about a few of these and you know, Are there ways around them? Are they endemic? For starters, and I think one that often comes up is the split of, questions of, you know, there's only so many hours in the day. There's only so much programming. Who gets to have a show and who doesn't? And if someone's got a show, are they entitled to have it till they're dead?
I mean, I think different stations have navigated that territory in different ways. Some stations have term limits. Some stations have annual renewals for contracts. Some stations let people on until they leave. There were actually a couple of cases that are kind of noteworthy in the community radio world of people who left their shows to other people in their will, who handed their shows off to people when they left, things like that. And It's definitely an area that, you know, each community has to negotiate its own terrain. But I think that what you find is in community radio in general, you've got lots of really, really talented people who are volunteering their time, giving of themselves, and have a lot that they want to share. And so the result of that is you do have some strong tensions around who gets on, what gets said, how do you determine, you know, who's voice is more valuable to put into those hours. And it's very important when a new station starts out to set up a very clear mission statement, to set up clear guidelines for how volunteers get a show, keep a show, evaluate the programming. Because even when everybody is in harmony at the beginning of a new project, you know, a couple of years down the line, oftentimes that'll come back to haunt you if you don't have those things set out very clearly so that everybody's on board. At WRT, we went through a big period of turmoil in the mid-1990s.
And I remember it well.
Came out of it very strong. And the reason was because we rewrote the bylaws, rewrote the sort of way the station was governed in such a way to enshrine democracy in that process, to involve all the different stakeholders, the listeners, the volunteers, the board, the staff, in the decision-making process for policies, for programming decisions. And so now people really do feel an ownership of each decision made, and it makes for better decisions.
Norm Stockwell, you know, one of the things that's striking to me, listening to a lot of community stations all over the country, and especially WEFT, and WART when I was in Madison, is that the politics in these stations tend to be liberal or progressive or on the political left. I would say almost uniformly. Not that every show is political. There's the majority of programming. There's no explicit politics at all. Oftentimes it's music, it's cultural fare. But to the extent there is public affairs programming, it runs liberal to the left. Is there, I mean, what would, is it just that there's no conservatives allowed? I mean, why, what would happen, you know, why aren't there Ann Coulter equivalents or Rush Limbaugh equivalents, or conservatives in the community say, I want a chance to come on the air in my community and do my broadcasting? Are they not allowed on the air? How does that work? What's, well, how do you explain that?
Well, again, I mean, I think each station negotiates its own territory in that way. But what I would say is that there are stations that have more conservative people involved, both in the governance and in the programming, and there's stations that consciously steer away from that, and there's stations that consciously take a more, for lack of a better word, left perspective on things. But really what community radio is all about is providing an alternative. In our mission statement at WORT, we talk about giving voice to the unrepresented and underrepresented segments of our community. Mm-hmm. And so what you find in the commercial radio world is there's a lot of dominance of the conservative voices and the, for lack of a better word, mainstream voices. And I mean, we can argue that point about what's really mainstream in this country, but the image that's created of mainstream tends to be a more conservative one. And so those voices get a lot of space on the commercial media. And so community radio stations very often, simply by saying we're going to provide an alternative, we're going to provide unheard voices, are therefore cast as consciously or unconsciously being more liberal or left, because they are giving voice to these other opinions, these different ways of thinking. Now, what I'd like to say is that, in fact, community radio, public radio, non-commercial radio is essential to a free and democratic society, because we do help create an informed electorate by giving people these other points of view, these other ways of looking at things, the other side of the issue, so that people can then make thoughtful decisions about their opinions about things and inform their elected representatives and so on. So you need non-commercial radio in order to have a thriving democracy. And that's not left, that's just democracy.
Probably the most successful program, and I might be wrong here, but my guess is, Norm Stockwell, the most successful program in community radio recent history has been Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which I know WRT was one of the first stations to carry it when it started in 1996, and now has expanded into this huge empire in Champaign-Urbana. It's available on the local public access channel, as well as the radio. I mean, it's an enormous program. It's got a huge audience. You've followed this from the beginning. You know Amy Goodman well. I mean, why has this show taken off as much as it has? What does it say about media in our society, and how much potential does programming like that have going forward?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things in that question. Why has the show done so well? Some of it was chance, the kind of being at the right place at the right time. When September 11th took place, and Democracy Now! At that time had just recently moved into new studios right near Ground Zero, and so mm-hmm. they were right on the scene when that happened. They were also, at the same time, in the same building as a community television station and experimenting with the idea of making that show available on television as well as radio. And so all of that took off at that moment in a way that might not have happened in another place or time. So there's that sort of chance mm-hmm. and luck thing. But there's also the incredible quality of Amy Goodman and her commitment to the notion of community radio, grassroots journalism, as she puts it, going to where the silence is and speaking out. And mm-hmm. she's tireless in her pursuit of, you know, getting those voices on the air. And that's, I think, been a major part of that show becoming as successful as it has, is that her commitment, her dedication to the work really shows through, not to mention her skill as an interviewer. I mean, I'm always amazed that you know, Amy is always able to ask exactly the right question at exactly the right moment. She's very, very thoughtful and very well educated in the topics that she covers, and is, you know, right there at the moment that she needs to be. And so I think that's really contributed to the show reaching up. But they're on 500 stations. They're distributing by satellite TV, cable access television, community radio, public radio, the internet. They're translated into Spanish. And the fact that the program is available in so many different formats is essential to its success as well, because not everybody has high-speed internet in their community. Not everybody has cable access TV in their community, unfortunately. And so the fact that you can get that show in so many different ways is a tribute to both the forethinking of people that put that together and the reason, I think, that it's so successful.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Norman Stockwell, Operations Coordinator for WRT, the community radio station in Madison, one of the national leaders of the community radio movement, and really a journalist who's covered media issues, radio issues around the world for, dare I say it, longer than he would like to probably admit, for many decades now, although you wouldn't know it to look at him. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580 in excuse me, in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, where Campbell Hall. And, you know, 2 weeks from today, again, we're going to have our Pledge Drive show with Bill Moyers and John Nichols and a lot of other people. So make sure you're listening in 2 weeks. We're going to do the special two-hour program. One thing I'd like to talk about, Norm Stockwell, is the question of the Internet. And I think in every topic and Media Matters that I have, with every guest we've had for the last 4 years, I can always turn, I don't always do it, but there's not one that I couldn't turn to and say at some point, well, how does the Internet affect what you're talking about? And in your case, more than any, I mean, the argument goes, who needs community radio? I mean, who needs radio? Who needs, we've got the Internet now. Why should we, isn't this horse and buggy technology, spending money transmitting a signal over these airwaves to antiquated radios that are soon going to be obsolete? Why shouldn't we just lower the cost dramatically, go online, and we don't need to have government licenses, and anyone can do their own thing online, and let there be a genuine marketplace of ideas. And if people really want to hear what you have to say, then they'll have anywhere in the world they'll have an opportunity to do so. Yep, sir, you've heard this question before. What's your response?
Yeah, well, I mean, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I don't think that broadcast radio is dead in any way, shape, or form. I mean, until you come up with, you know, web browsing in your car as you're driving on the highway, there's not going to be a suitable replacement for the reach and the power of broadcast radio. It also can be heard in places, you know, where you can't get high-speed internet. There's a lot of places in rural America where you still can't get DSL or cable, and people are survive based on hearing things on the radio because they can't get the internet at their home. But also, I think that the internet is a technology that radio is partnering with in some really successful and creative ways. Streaming online has been around for a while now, and a lot of stations are taking advantage of that so that their programs reach out to listeners across the globe. This program, for instance, is being streamed right now on WILL's website. Podcasting, which, just to clarify, podcasting really has a very specific meaning, which is the marriage of two technologies, downloadable MP3 files and RSS syndication technology, which allows you to subscribe to programs. Mm-hmm. That's made an amazing difference for people to be able to basically get the latest news from their favorite shows without having to go out and look for it.
Well, certainly our show, you know, the vast majority of listeners we have now come via podcasting.
So I think that all of these technologies are working in tandem with community radio to broaden the reach, to expand the audience, but I don't think that any one of them is replacing any other.
But at some point down the road, I mean, it seems inevitable that, I don't know when it's going to be, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 25 years, but I don't think it's going to be more than 25 years. You know, everything will be online, and we'll get everything through a digital format directly, and I don't think the traditional airwaves will be used at some point in the way they're currently being used. And if that does take place, humor me with that presupposition, then is there a place for community radio? Will that just be an artifact of the 20th century and maybe the first decade of the 21st century?
Well, you know, what's interesting is it was probably
I should also add to that, not just community radio, but national public radio, PBS, the works.
It was probably 10 or 12 years ago that Internet prognosticator Nicholas Negroponte said there's this technology flip-flop that goes on where everything that we know of as wireless becomes wired and everything that we know of as wired becomes wireless. And we've seen that dramatically in the last few years where, for instance, with television, after September 11th, broadcast television in New York City was off the air for 2 weeks, and no one noticed because everyone in New York is watching cable. Mm-hmm. They're getting their television through a wire instead of through the air.
Yeah.
And yet telephones, which we always grew up with as being, you know, plugged into the wall, are now mostly wireless. And many people have a wireless phone and no landline at all.
Yeah.
So in the case of radio, I think we're seeing that as well. We're seeing this flip-flop where some things are going over to the internet, but also the internet itself is beginning to be delivered wirelessly. And so without wanting to kind of invest in the stock market on this prediction, I think that what we're going to see is that a radio style of delivery of more content than simply broadcast radio is what we're looking at in 25 years. Not that radio is going to die and go over to the internet, but rather the internet and radio are going to become more closely married.
Now, just to make that a little less abstract, Norm, that means that at some point there will be a device where someone will be able to listen to any number, probably thousands and thousands of radio stations, if not access to millions. And that all of them will be available on this device, and it won't come via the airwaves per se, unless the digital transmission of the web's internet via the airwaves. But it will be something that anyone can do by putting basically setting up a website.
Yeah, well, I think that what we'll see is that
in that case, then the traditional broadcast frequency will no longer be a factor.
Well, I think that I think that those broadcast frequencies will become the method of delivering.
This broader panoply of
right. Now you're going to have a device that's going to be able to see television and radio and email and everything else, and it'll be getting its signal through the air, not plugged into the wall. And so in that sense, really, radio doesn't die, but it evolves and joins together with internet technology. Now, it's worth noting that there's a lot of tension right now about what's going to happen with the internet, and you, Bob, and your organization Free Press have been very much on top of this and leaders in the movement for net neutrality, for an open internet rather than a kind of a commercializing and a superhighway and a side access road kind of concept. And so I think that you know, people need to be aware of that issue, because if we're going to have the ability to receive all these different community radio stations and receive programs like Democracy Now! Over our internet, we need to make sure that that internet is available to everyone, whether they be a small community organization or a large corporate giant.
And I should add that our guest today, Norm Stockwell, the operations coordinator at WRT FM, the community radio station in Madison and one of the national leaders in this area, you've been real active on those issues, I know, on the importance of wireless internet, keeping the internet open. And you've been active in the whole front of issues related to creating and spawning a viable independent alternative media, not just concerned with commercial radio. Our guest today, as I said, Norm Stockwell. Our phone numbers here at WILL AM 580-333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. You know, going back, Norm Stockwell, if we can, for a second, to really a new technology, but really one of our great old technologies, radio, low-power FM radio, has emerged in the last decade, almost ironically, in view of what we've been talking about with the internet, as this sort of dynamic area. And there are low-power stations in Urbana. There's one that's coming in Madison. They're all over the country. We're seeing barn raisings done by people at Prometheus Radio out of Philadelphia to help people in their community set up these LPFM stations. And you've been involved in this. And I mean, this is going to sound rhetorical, but it's actually a very serious question. As the head of a community station, isn't there sort of a territorial side of you that doesn't really want a competitor that's going after the same audience, basically the same funding base, in your community?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question, because as low-power FM was first being proposed and then first beginning to emerge as a new territory, the FCC started talking about this in 1999. They issued a proposed rulemaking. They took comments. NPR was one of the opponents to low-power FM, and NPR opposed it exactly for the reasons that you're saying. Yeah. That is, concern about both interference, technical interference, that is, you know, static on your receiver, but also interference in the audience, the underwriters, the pledgers, and so on. Our station has kind of taken a different approach, which is we feel it's the tide that lifts all ships, that the more people listen to alternative media, the more people will be listening to alternative media. I like to use the example of State Street in Madison, Wisconsin, the street that runs down by the university campus.
It's similar to Green Street in Champaign.
All right. And if you walk down that street and you say to, you know, any number of students, what would you like to hear on the radio? They're going to say, oh, I want to hear 24 hours a day of Madonna or Prince or whatever the current vogue is.
You're dating yourself.
Yeah, I know. I know. But the reason for that is because they've never heard the Bulgarian Women's Vocal Choir or the throat singers of Tuva or, in many cases, even Ani DeFranco. Mm-hmm. And so what we do in the non-commercial community radio world is we expose people to these alternatives and then let them make an educated decision. Now, expand that to the whole radio dial. If people are only used to listening to commercial radio, they only know that kind of narrow, segmented pablum programming that they're receiving on the commercial radio. And commercial radio is very much into target marketing. You know, this is the station for the, you know, 18 to 24-year-old males. This
determined is the station by what marketers want.
Right. And so we feel that the more people listen to any kind of alternative media, the more their eyes and their minds and their consciousness will be opened up to seeking out alternatives. And it's interesting, if you look nationwide, what you can see is that people are desperate for an alternative. People are hungry for an alternative, and you see that in many, many different ways. You see that in the increased audience to community and public radio, the increased listener support. You see that in the increased hits on the indie media websites. You see it in the increased subscriptions to the different satellite TV networks. People are looking for an alternative because they know that commercial media is not giving them a full picture. And that's also, I think, connected to why you've seen such a rise in the blogosphere on the internet, because people are out there looking for other opinions. They don't want to take just what the, you know, the big three networks or the major newspapers are telling them. They want more information. And so Low Power FM is one way that people can get more information about their very, very local issues, their small, you know, 1 to 3 mile radius local community, a housing project, a neighborhood, a small town, can get their voices out on the air now through Low Power FM.
You know, there actually is research that backs up your sort of gut feeling, which is the community that has the greatest percentage of nonprofit and non-commercial radio stations in the United States is the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul. And as these stations were added, and they built up just a real arsenal of stations there below 92, what they found is the percentage of the listening audience that went to that area just increased significantly. That just, like you said, people were exposed to them, stuck there with all the different choices, and it built up everyone's audience. So, and on that note, I should say, in fairness to NPR, as LPFM is now being considered again in Washington, there are promising signs that they are coming around understanding that this is actually not a threat to them, but something that could be a good thing for all non-commercial broadcasters in the United States. Our guest, again, is Norman Stockwell, the operations coordinator at WRT in Madison, and one of the leaders of community radio in the country. And Norm, earlier we were talking about, you know what, let's go to the phone lines. We have a few people waiting patiently, and I've been yakking here quite a bit. Let's start with line four, our toll-free number from Farina, Illinois. Farina, you're on the air with Norm Stockwell.
Hi, another great opportunity to talk to your show here. I listen to your show on a clock radio.
I can't hear the caller here.
Yeah, unfortunately, hello? We're not hearing the caller.
Hello?
From Farina. I apologize.
Hello?
Oh, yeah, here we are. Hello, Farina.
Hi. It's just great to be able to call into a show with you know, wonderful guests. I listen on a clock radio and a landline. There's no I live in a small community where there's no newspaper. The volunteer, if there's an emergency, you just hear the siren of the volunteer fire department, so you don't even know what's happening, you know, two blocks from here. On the community radio question, I think people crave reality. I think I saw a speech by Michael Parenti the other day that and I'm a longtime fan of his, but he made the comment that reality is radical. People, it's the big media that wants to cook the, you know, cook the information. And so I just agree with everything you've said. But the other question, the real question I have is, now you've announced that your station, WLL, is going to go digital. Will I have to buy a different radio? And that's my main question. And then thanks for all your good work. And and one other thing. I finally got a satellite dish, and Free Speech TV is – I already was familiar with Link, which has been wonderful this weekend, and Free Speech TV is another little window into the world there. So thanks a lot.
That's a great question, Farina, about digital radio, because for the sake of our listeners, I'll just preface this, and then I'm going to let Norm Stockwell answer it. As radio makes its transition from traditional analog, what it is now, to digital, it does involve all new equipment. It's really a different technology. You can't use the same receiver, you can't use the same transmitter, and all the stations in the country like WRT and WFT and WIL are all facing this. But it also opens up radical possibilities to open up the system to let lots of new voices in. Technologically, the traditional barriers that limit us to the number of stations we have over there in a community go right out the window. We could double, triple, quadruple them with very little spectrum. How is our society addressing this transition to digital radio?
Well, calm the callers a little bit and say that right now, digital radio is not going to replace your old analog radio. You'll still be able to listen to the main channel of WILL on your clock radio. What you won't be able to do is to get these second and third channels that Bob is mentioning that are going to be available. Digital radio technology has emerged in a couple of different forms around the world. And in some countries, they have a whole separate segment of the radio spectrum, a different set of channels, if you will, that are available.
Sort of like FM to AM.
Right. Well, or more like what's happening with television, where in the television conversion that's going on right now, the analog TV stations are going to go away. Mm-hmm. And only digital television. In radio in the United States, that's not the path that they chose. And it was partly because the military was camped out on the frequencies that might have been available, and they didn't want to let them go for a new digital radio. So in the United States, we came up with a system that's called IBOC. And IBOC is just an acronym that means in-band on channel.
And we are using euphemistically, since probably about 100 people on Earth were familiar with this discussion.
Right. But what they decided was that the digital radio frequencies will be in the same place as your existing analog channel. And so wherever you're listening to WILL right now on your AM or FM radio,
580, AM 580,
the digital frequencies will be in the same place, but you'll need a special receiver to decode those. And so people don't, at least at this point in history, and I don't want to predict, you know, 10 years out, but right now people don't have to buy new radios. In the world of television, they do.
Yeah, they will.
In the world of television, by February of 2009, right now is currently the cutoff date, your regular analog TV set will not work anymore, and you'll have to buy a new digital receiver or a converter box.
That's right. Our guest, Norm Stockwell, operations coordinator at WRT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin, one of the leaders of community radio broadcasting in the United States. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Anchorage, on the air with Norm Stockwell.
Hello. I have a question for you, Norm. This is Jeremy.
Hey.
Well, my friends and I sometimes talk about what would happen if there's a national crisis and the internet goes down. You were talking about the internet being vulnerable, and I have thought about just recently what's going on in Burma, where the internet and telephones have been cut off. So your thoughts on what would happen if there's a national crisis and what role local broadcasting would play?
That's a great question. And Norm, I mean, is that a realistic possibility technologically? Can it be shut down fairly easily, the internet in the United States? I thought it was set up so it could survive nuclear attacks and wackos and terrorists. You know, wasn't that the whole idea, that it didn't have a central switch you could turn on or off?
I mean, what's interesting about the internet is that it has developed in such a way that there's lots and lots of tendrils out there. And I pretty sure that nobody knows all of the different paths that are on the internet right now. So there's old machines, you know, from the 70s that are still switching internet signals somewhere in different places around the country. So that's very good.
Yeah. The decentralization that was supposed to be its safeguard.
Right. And the fact that you can still dial in with a dial-up modem to many internet providers allows you to be able to access the net even when the various broadband connections go down, there's satellite internet, and so on. But by the same token, if you look at what happened in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina basically knocked out almost everything in New Orleans, is almost all of the internet connectivity, landline telephones, everything were knocked down by that tragedy. There was a great story I remember running at the time of this small data center where the workers were staying. They'd locked themselves inside and they had some food and so on. They were keeping some of that internet connection going, but a lot of the city was without service. Mm-hmm. And people came in with small portable wireless transmitters and set up a wireless mesh network to try and provide some internet connectivity for the residents because the FEMA forms that you had to fill out were only available online. So the internet is certainly important in a crisis, but it's only as important as it can reach people. Radio, on the other hand, can be set up much more cheaply, much more quickly, and reach large communities with information. In the case of, again, Hurricane Katrina, you had people that were going in there providing radio programming and handing out small crank radios and battery-powered radios to people to get information out. In the rest of the world, you see in rural areas Guatemala and places like that where radio is the only source of not only things like health information and safety information, but oftentimes communication. A radio station that I've worked with in El Salvador has a program where people call in messages. And so somebody might call in and say, you know, this is so-and-so calling from San Salvador, and I'm taking the bus up on Friday at 2 o'clock, and I need somebody to help me carry the sack of potatoes back to the village. And so radio is used in that way. And during the Y2K, a lot of people were working on setting up radio response teams to be able to get word out to people if there was a shutdown of other sorts of power and so on. There's people doing experiments with solar-powered radio transmitters, as well as, of course, the solar receivers that were pioneered in South Africa, where you have communities where they don't have batteries.
So you don't even need electricity or batteries.
That's right. Extraordinary. A crank or a solar cell that allows your radio to receive the important information about health, about safety, about natural disasters.
We've got a couple callers waiting patiently, Norm Stockwell, and I want to get to both of them before the show ends in a few minutes. So let's go now to line two, Champaign County. Thank you for your patience. You're on there with Norm Stockwell.
Hi, good afternoon. I guess you sort of led into what I wanted to ask about, which is the international dimension and various forms, community radio, and the various, you know, sort of contrary globalization for below is happening. And I enjoyed your coverage from Porto Alegre, so I think you probably can work that in as well, the idea that, you know, when a few billionaires get together in Davos, Switzerland, the yards of column inch and bandwidth get expended on covering them. But when thousands of people gather in various social forums around the world, it lends to the idea that there is no alternative when, as you gentlemen know quite well, there is a lot of alternatives. So I'm losing my voice here for some reason. So I think
you're choked up being on the air with Norm Stockwell. It happens to me, too.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Well, thank you very much. Well, this actually was something I'm glad he asked that because I very much wanted to draw on your expertise globally because you do travel around, especially to the third world. I mean, you really do get a chance to see how radio works and how media work in a way that few Americans do.
Well, and I want to thank the caller for also mentioning the World Social Forums, which I have had the opportunity to cover, working with a group called AMARC, A-M-A-R-C, which is the World Association of Community Broadcasters. And this is an organization that brings together community broadcasters in Africa, Asia, Latin America, North America as well. And it's interesting to get together with people doing community radio in all these different places because everybody has incredible stories to share, and there's a lot of a lot of commonalities between all of us, but there's also a lot of differences. I mean, you have community radio stations that are regularly still today being blown up by governments, being shut down by governments, being repressed in various ways. You have a lot of places in the world where there is no legal community radio sector, where there's either government only or military or maybe commercial, but it's fairly rare to find a space that's protected mm-hmm. for non-commercial or community radio. And some community radios around the globe are commercial as well. We should mention usually having local advertisements for mm-hmm. businesses in their community. But the importance of radio in the world cannot be underestimated, and we've seen a huge rise.
Well, can be underestimated. It can't be exaggerated.
It can't be exaggerated. Thank you. and we've seen a huge rise in the flourishing of community radios across the globe. I was just at the conference of AMARC, the World Association of Community Broadcasters, in Amman, Jordan, last November, about a year ago, and while we were there, the country of India created a sector for community radio. This is a battle that's been being waged by local communities in India for a dozen years or so to try and get the government to recognize community radio, and now it's available for people.
You know, we only have time for one caller left, and our caller is a voice that will be recognized to most of our listeners, the longtime host of Media Minutes, who's also one of the great experts on radio in this country as well. We're very fortunate to welcome Line 3, Champagne, John Anderson. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks, Bob, and hi, Norm.
Hi, John.
Too bad we're out of time because I had a couple of questions. The first comment I wanted to make, though, was you should really consider doing a show on digital radio because while only 100 people might know about it and less than 450,000 people a week actually listen to it, the technology is coming and it does have implications for the future of radio that should probably be a little bit more closely discussed. And just
duly noted, John.
Yes. And the question I had for Norm was there's another segment of community radio which has a long history in the United States and around the world, and that is unlicensed or pirate broadcasting. It was the work of a lot of unlicensed broadcasters that helped push the FCC toward implementing a low-power FM radio service. And even though the LPFM service is now in place, there is still an incredible amount of demand, especially in the urban areas where pirates are flourishing. And I just wanted to get your sense of whether you think that's still a viable way by which people can gain access to the airwaves, regardless of the potential risk they face from busting by the FCC, and whether or not you think that has any future going forward. So I'll hang up and take my call off the air and hope to talk to both of you later. Thanks.
Okay, John, thanks a lot. We still got a couple of minutes left, so you don't have to rush through it too quickly, Norm.
Yeah, well, I think that the caller is absolutely right, and our caller, John Anderson, has studied pirate radio and is very knowledgeable in this area. Pirate radio in the United States in the 70s was, in most cases, what I would call vanity radio. That is, it was people that were broadcasting because they wanted to hear their voice or they wanted to play their songs. But then starting in the 1980s, a new movement emerged. And in fact, they ended up changing their name from pirate radio to micro radio because it really was a different kind of thing. And what it was, it was very much like the start of community radio. It was people who wanted to get alternative voices on the air. Our own station, WORT, started in the time of Watergate, when people were feeling there wasn't a good voice for news. Well, the 1980s was the time of Reagan and later Bush, and you had these small micro-broadcasters coming up all over the country with a very important political message providing alternatives to the line that was coming out from the U.S. government about the wars in Central America, about the AIDS epidemic, about what was happening in small communities. There's been some very famous broadcasters doing this kind of micro radio, and it really should be honored as an important part of the tradition of independent media, the voices of independent media.
Okay, I'm going to pull a Tim Russert here. Is there a future for unlicensed broadcasting? Yes or no? Or maybe?
Well, I think that, the engineering is important. Stations have to be careful not to step on other stations because everyone deserves a voice. It's like shared space.
Yeah.
But I think that if people can do that, I think there's a lot more room on the dial than we're currently filling.
All right. Thank you so much, Norm Starkel, for joining us today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I want to thank Camilla Kovacs for sitting in for Andrew Boyle today. And I definitely want to thank Technical Director Matt Kessler, does a terrific job on the board for us there at WILL AM 580. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours. Have a great week.